Acts 5. We are at a place in the book of Acts where the Jerusalem church is in a state of great activity. There's a flurry of activity. You have had a little persecution as we look back in Acts chapter 4. You have the information about Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. You have a lot of evangelistic activity taking place. A lot of people are becoming Christians. You also have several healings. So on many fronts, things are really popping. And I think that helps you understand a little bit better when you get to Acts chapter 6. Anybody remember one of the big points from Acts 6? Some other men begin to emerge. What do we have there?
Choosing of the seven that nobody's really sure if they were considered deacons or not, servants.
Seven special helpers. So at least they're doing deacon-like work if they were not deacons. And that makes perfect sense when you look at the chapters which lead up to that, because there's now so much going on that they needed to bring in some additional people, and that's exactly what happened. We didn't get completely through with Acts chapter 5, verse 13 last week, so let's take a look at that 13th verse, make a couple more points, and then we'll deal with verses, Acts 5, 14, then we'll deal with verses 15 and 16 after that. We'll look at verse 12 as far as reading, because that's where the paragraph begins. And by the hands of the apostles were many signs and wonders wrought among the people, and they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. But of the rest, durst no man join himself to them, howbeit the people magnified them. And then, of course, you have the believers being added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women. A couple things about this. Luke may have mentioned the women for a couple of things. What do you read about in Acts chapter 6? Ray just highlighted it for us. The seven fellows are selected for what purpose?
The widows.
So he may have introduced that here as far as the women, because that was an issue. But there's also another thing, and I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to necessarily give you my input on this, but I will give you this quote. I'll put it that way, okay? He said, Luke may have mentioned women because they are more sentimental and impulsive, but men are less easily moved by feeling and judgment. Now, whether you like that quote or not, that's up to you. But there are some differences between men and women. And I think the point that the fellow was making is that the gospel has how much appeal? You have women who have some things about their nature that are specific to them. You have men who have a nature that's specific to them. And yet, what do you find with the gospel? It appeals to all. Now, that's not true of everything in life, isn't it? Is it? Don't you find some things that specifically appeal to women, some things that specifically appeal to men? What would some examples be? All right, sports. That would be, you know, you find some ladies that may be interested in sports, but oftentimes we associate men more with sports. We were in Sam's the other day, Teresa and I, we were walking in there together, and there were some neat bags. And the bags potentially could have been used by a man or a woman. I liked the bag. Teresa liked the bag. But, you know, as we looked at the bags, they had about three colors, three styles, and they were all girly. I can't imagine anyone but the most effeminate man saying, I'm going to carry one of those bags. Now, I like the style, I like the design, I like the pockets, I like everything about the bag. But I thought, there is no way I wouldn't be caught dead holding one of those things. I'm not going to use that, even for a tool bag. So, you do have sometimes, as I say, these distinctions, but it's interesting that the gospel does apply to all people. Acts 5, verse 14, a couple of the things that are noteworthy. As you look at the number of people, and your translation may vary a little bit, but how is it described? How many people were becoming Christians? There were?
Multitude.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Generally, when you think about the word multitude, does it have an S on the end? What's a multitude?
A lot.
So when you go from multitude, no S, to multitudes, plural, that's not a typo. What's that tell you? You're dealing with bunches and bunches and bunches. And this is the only time in the New Testament where that word which is translated multitude is expressed with a plural. And it's almost like you have a steady stream of people flowing into the church. Now, if you think back a little bit, well, let's go back and look at it. Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. This is Isaiah's prophecies, one of his prophecies about the New Testament church. And as you look at Isaiah 2, and as you look at Acts chapter 5, verse 14, it almost seems like so many people are becoming Christians at this point in time that Luke stops counting them. Now, he has given us some indications Acts 2, for example, Acts chapter 4, but now the growth of the church is so substantial, people are flowing in so often that it's, I mean, I don't think that they lost count, but it's kind of like the numbers are just too big to continue to count. Who's got it? Isaiah 2, 2 to 4. All right, Betty. Now think about that. They'll stream. They'll flow. That was the prophecy. And now as we look at, you sort of see that in Acts 2, and by the time of Acts 4, there's more of that. But now by the time in Acts chapter 5, verse 14, that is exactly what's taking place. So by that word multitudes, you might want to insert Isaiah 2 and the word translated stream or flow. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Acts 5, 15 and 16? Stan?
This is a general question that's going to cover this whole first period of the church, but how many of these people were already convinced of what the Lord had to offer? How many people did he teach? How many people had become convinced that what he had to say was something that they should be attracted to or adhere to, and that then when the church came into being and Peter was preached to them, they were already of a mind to become Christians. So I guess my question is, were they just at this point in time, how many of these multitudes were people that were just waiting, essentially, to find out the word that Peter had for them, and they went from being those who were convinced that what Jesus was saying was correct to being transferred into the church because baptism for remission of sins then, you know, was the fence or whatever that they had to cross over to become a part of the church?
Okay, my answer may not completely answer your question, so if it doesn't, let me know and we'll follow up with that. But when you think about Jesus, how long roughly was his earthly ministry?
3 years.
And how fully do you think he'd covered the area of Palestine with the apostles? When you look at his travels, I mean, he's not spending all of his time in Jerusalem, is he? You know, he's up there in Samaria for a little while. He gets up into Galilee. I mean, he's making the rounds. And after 3 years, that's a long stretch of time. So you would think that just about everybody has heard about the Lord, and then the information about the crucifixion, the information about the resurrection. And then, too, remember what Jesus said on a couple of occasions. He said, the fields are what? They are white unto harvest. And he was warning his disciples, look, there are some people out here who are good soil. They need some more teaching, and I'm kind of here, and I'm preparing things, and I'm sowing some seeds, and you guys are going to go in, and you're going to do some reaping as far as the crops. And then remember, too, another statement. He said, you are like sheep without a shepherd. So people were looking for some kind of leadership. So there had been no prophet for about 400 years. When Malachi closes out, it's kind of like God's been silent for four centuries. So the people are hungry. And John the Baptist shows up and gets a pretty good reception. And I think the reason for that is the people were looking for something. They didn't like the Roman oppression and so forth. So to use the old expression, the pump has been primed. And that's why they tried to make Jesus a king. So everything is in place, and then the apostles start coming along and they start doing miracles. And it was, I think in the minds of many, the point had to be, can anybody do anything greater? I mean, you start raising the dead, you're healing the blind, you're curing the lepers, that you're walking on water, you're stilling storms. I mean, we can't imagine that there would be any kind of activity that would be greater than that. In fact, when you look at, I don't remember if it was the Pharisees or the Sadducees, but they asked for a sign from heaven, and the sign was some kind of heavenly sign, you know, make the stars fall down or make the sun turn upside down, do something. And that's about the only place that the mind can go. I mean, if you're changing things on the earth, then the next step up from there would be something in the heavenly constellations. So having said all that, it seems to me that everything was in place. So it was just, it's almost like selling something to somebody. A person comes into the car dealership, they're 90% sure that they're going to buy a car that day. And all that the salesman does is they give that last 10% push because the person is already 90% sold. And that's what I suspect that you have with a lot of the gospel. That good and honest hearts, they were already basically sold. It was just give us the guidance, point us in the right direction, tell us what God requires, and we're willing to do it. Anybody else? Don?
Look, prior to Jesus coming, prior to his work of 3 years, basically it was the spiritual leaders that told the Jewish people what to do. Mm-hmm. When basically everything, of course, was concerned, right?
Yeah.
And here you have, it's almost like a democracy in a way, that Peter and these guys would be fishermen. Now they're leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not leaders in the old sense of the Pharisees or the priests. You know, it's bringing religion, spirituality, down to the common man.
Yeah.
So they're flocking to this notion that they can be involved personally and not being directed by somebody that was ordained by God, as quote unquote. So that has to have a lot of appeal for
it. Absolutely. When you look at, for example, Matthew 23, that's the place where you have the scathing rebuke by Jesus, and he talks about the religious leaders, how they bound heavy burdens on people. Can you imagine you go to your synagogue service, and they're binding you with all kinds of rules, and you know, you're walking in thinking, well, hey, I'd like a message from God today. And you get 75 rules, and you walk out thinking, oh, that's terrible. And then you see how those guys live. They're hypocritical. You know, they're telling you not to steal, but they're over there, you know, stealing from the guy or over there doing this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, you're thinking, surely there's got to be a better way. And then Jesus shows up and the apostles start teaching, and then all of a sudden it's the doors open. And yes, that had to be really, and not only from a male perspective, but what about the women? Can you imagine being a female in that culture? Remember, the temple had various courts. And if you're a woman, how far do you get? You've got the Gentiles out there, and where do you go? Be right there with the heathens. Well, that makes you feel pretty special, doesn't it? And then the gospel comes along and says, well, hey, look, in Christ, Galatians 3, 27 and 28, you're baptized into Christ, and there can be neither Jew nor Greek, bond or free, male nor female. So going back to where we just were, multitudes of men and women, were really elevated by the gospel. And they had to say, wow, this is the best news we've had in a long time. Even in this country, when you go back and you look at voting rights, women were not always allowed to vote. And though that was something that would predate us, can you imagine what women felt like when they were finally allowed to vote or drive? Maybe in some countries we can finally now drive, or we can go out and not have to wear special clothing. What a relief. So yeah, all that had to tie into that too. Anybody else? Minute.
In our ladies' class that we're studying, we had one of the chapters about dress, the way women were treated in first century Christianity, and the difference that they could be seen by the people that had become Christians, that the difference could be seen in the way the women acted and the way they were treated by their spouse. Than what they had been previously.
Yeah.
So that was another big thing that was being seen throughout their cities and towns.
Yeah. Women were basically property, treated like a dog or treated like a tool. And when you look at passages, for example, Peter talks about giving honor unto the woman. Anybody remember the rest of that? As unto the weaker vessel. Now, in our day and time, when people hear that, what do they do? Oh, you're the weaker vessel. Wow, the Bible is a sexist book. That is a terrible book. Well, when you pair a male against a female, there are going to be some differences, as we mentioned earlier. Some of those differences are going to be physical strength. A man can often take more punishment physically than a woman can. So there are some definite senses in which a woman is going to be the weaker vessel. Not weaker mentally, not weaker spiritually, but weaker physically. And yet, what does Peter say? Give what? Give honor unto that woman. So there's the contrast. In the first century, wives are nothing more than property. You know, trade them around, pass them around. We didn't like her after 6 months, so we traded her in for a better model. And God comes along and says, give honor unto the weaker vessel. Now, if you were a woman in that day and time, and your husband was interested in Christianity, how interested do you think you'd be? This is going to change our life. We're going to have a completely different household. So because of the culture in which the gospel first went, it was very, very attractive. Is that it? Okay, let's look at Acts 5. Moving now down to verses 15 and 16. Insomuch that they even carried out the sick into the streets and laid them on beds and couches, that as Peter came by, at the least his shadow might overshadow some of them. And there also came together the multitude. Now notice that we've gone from the plural to the singular. I said it was used just one time in the New Testament. We've seen that. From the cities round about Jerusalem, bringing sick folk and them that were vexed with unclean spirits, and they were healed. How many? Everyone. Now Luke talked about healing back in Acts chapter 5, verse 12. He's given us a little bit of a break, a little bit of an interlude, and now he comes back to that. And here he makes a general reference to medical miracles. It's interesting. You could probably get this impression from the text. It's certainly true in the original text that you have a number of present tense verbs, ongoing activity. And here are some examples. The Bible says they were carrying them. That's present tense. The King James uses the word brought. And they're carrying them, ongoing action. They're laying them. That's another continuous action verb. A King James says passing by. In the first part of verse 16, you also have the present tense being used to describe a crowd of people. People were not just gathering, they continued to gather together. And then as you look at the middle of verse 16, you have that word bringing. That's also expressed with the present tense. And then what would you expect with a healing? So you've got all these people coming, and with the healing, it's also present tense. It's almost like an assembly line. They have raw material that's coming in, and they have finished products that are going out. And it's just that steady stream, and it's just that cycle just repeats and repeats and repeats. And that's why I said at the beginning of class that there had to be a flurry of activity going on. I don't think the church was ever probably too inactive in Jerusalem up to this point, but things just continued to pick up steam and speed, and we're going to see as we get down into further verses that Jews finally become so aware of this that they feel like they've got to take an act. They've got to act. All right, now, think about this. Even in our culture, if you have the sick people, not only in Jerusalem, but people outside the area of Jerusalem, and they're thinking, we can get healing for free, be completely healed, and we're going to bring the sick into the city, and we're going to put them into the streets. What do you think is going to happen with that? I'll give you a minute to think about that, and I'll make a couple of the points. He says that they were carried into the streets. Remember that word which is translated wide in Matthew 7? Jesus said the gate to hell is wide. The gate to life is narrow. When you think about that wide gate in Matthew 7, that's the same word that's translated street here. So these were large areas. These were open areas. These were places where you might think that you would find a public square. Now, even though there would have been, comparatively speaking, a lot of space to some smaller spaces, still, when you start bringing lots of people in, sick people, and you start bringing them into the streets, you don't have cars and you don't have some other things, but what's going to happen probably?
Traffic.
Well, I was thinking of a different word, but traffic or congestion. We know what that's like in this area. Get stopped by a train, traffic becomes snarled, or maybe you have a buggy on the road, those kinds of things, and traffic gets backed up for a while. Can you imagine all the sick people? And can you imagine, too, you know, you see somebody coughing a little, oh, you know, I don't want to be close to you. Can you imagine what it must have been like to go to some of the parts in Jerusalem? I mean, it just had to be overwhelming, sick people. It reminds me almost of a war zone. You've had an area that's been attacked, and now you have people out there that are trying to do triage. Let's see who's the worst and sort people out, and you've just got a compilation of different medical issues. So this had to be a truly amazing sight. But also, this helps set the stage for about what we're going to see here in a little bit. If you had this kind of thing, whose attention are you going to get in the city?
Officials.
Yeah. The officials are going to start paying attention because you're disrupting the traffic flow of things. So even if you're walking, even if you're using animals to, you know, get, can you imagine coming to town in a buggy? You got sick people out there in the streets. So even with the transportation that they had in this day and time, that would have been a difficulty. Yeah, so when we say wide, it's not like it was a freeway where you've got six lanes of traffic in California or another state where you've got a lot of open territory. So, yes. And again, when you start thinking about all the people who are coming in, continuous action, it was a mess.
Give me the visual on beds and couches.
I'm about to do that. I'm glad you asked about that. But let's make sure that we don't have any other questions before we turn to beds and couches. Done?
Maybe it's after you answer that, I've got a question.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take beds and couches first. When you look at people today, it's like anything else. If you're dealing with cars, if you're dealing with furniture, anybody ever go into, well, I'm not going to mention the furniture store because sure enough, if I do, somebody's going to say that's where I got her living room. Anybody ever go into a discount furniture store? All right, most of us have. Anybody ever been in a high-end furniture store, kind of like maybe some of the Amish areas out here? And, okay, you can buy a bed for $100 over there at the discount furniture store. You go over here to Amish land, and what's it going to run you? Yeah, it's probably going to run you $1,000. So there's a big disparity. Now, you get a bed from both places, but the bed, as far as the quality, is going to be vastly different for a lot of reasons. And that's what you have here, I think, Sherman, as far as a distinction. The beds would have described what the rich people had. And as you look at that, I'll give you a formal description here. Usually a thick, coarse mattress stuffed with cotton or wool, and they were owned by the rich. The couches, on the other hand, anybody ever been up to maybe Christian camp and you slept on a little thin pad? Or you've been out there in the tent and somebody said, we've got this pad, and it's about half an inch thick. So there was a great disparity there as far as what the rich were brought on. Some have taken that second word, which is translated bed, or couch, translated couch, and compared it to a stretcher. So I've never been carried on a stretcher, but when you look at them, at least some of the older ones, maybe a camp stretcher, they don't look all that comfortable. So, I mean, they will get you to where you need to go, but as far as being something that you want to spend a lot of time on, probably not. But that second word, it was not used to describe the couches on which guests would recline at dinner time, but the other one was. So you not only have a bunch of sick people coming, but you have also the beds as well. Now, in that vein of thought, if you have someone who's fairly wealthy, they're coming with their bed, just human nature, do you think they might want to carry a few other things with them if they have a lot of money? I would think they probably want a few other accessories as well. So the person might be coming with a little bit more than the bed, and that also could have helped clog things up a bit. Sherman, back to you.
They probably
had an animal to help. Well, yeah. If you're thinking about the rich people, if you have enough money to hire somebody out, it's probably, especially if you're coming from a ways, you're not going to carry me by hand. I want to come in the wagon and so forth. And maybe they're not storing a wagon right there in the street, but still, that has to go somewhere. Let's tie this in with what we know. Remember Jerusalem, Jesus' final Passover with the disciples? What did we learn from that class? Passover time, you've got Jews coming from every area. What's the problem in town?
Congestion.
No housing. And that's why the Lord, you find special arrangements. He says, there's going to be this man. He's going to have this room, and it's going to have enough space for all of us. It's going to be a private area. And it was kind of like, wow, really? That kind of thing exists at Passover time? But God made special or providential preparations for that. So this was a big deal. I don't know, but maybe the people who were coming exceeded the number for Passover. If that was true, this really was an overflow crowd. Bonnie?
Where are you getting from beds and couches, rich and poor? Is that a Greek?
There are two different words in the original text. So as you look at the word and how it's used, what it's applied to, the one would have described, for example, the beds. That was sometimes used to describe what people would recline on. It was sturdier material. For example, it would be, when we think about lawn chairs, for example, you can walk into Menards and probably buy a lawn chair for $7.99. Anybody want to guess what kind of lawn chair that's going to be? You don't want to be much over 100 pounds if you're going to use that lawn chair. I mean, if you have somebody who weighs about 300 pounds and they sit in that, it's probably going to break. But then you can go out and you can spend at another store $20, $30, $40, $50 on a lawn chair, and whatever size a person may be, whatever the weight is, it's probably going to be perfectly fine. It's probably going to be perfectly comfortable. So you have two different chairs, but they're going to be vastly different in quality. And those two different words would follow the same idea here.
American standard says cots and
pallets. Okay, so again, they're trying to bring out that distinction that they were not quite the same thing.
Cots and what?
Pallets. Don?
Help me with this.
Okay.
It said, and those who were tormented by unclean spirits.
Okay, we're going to get to that too. But I just want to make sure that we go through this sequentially. So it's also important, and we will talk about that. Therese?
I never thought about it before today, but the germs.
Oh, yeah.
When you have a group of congested people, they spread germs. But if everyone was healed, apparently everyone was contracted a new illness.
Yeah. I could say if you were a city official and you have all kinds of sick people coming in now, some could have maybe not been the coughing kind of sickness. They have maybe an arm that's not working, something like that. But yeah, you know, you're talking about bringing potentially all kinds of diseases into an area. And that had to be a big concern for folks. So what does that tell you about the apostles' power? I mean, they're just wiping out the disease, whatever it was. Now, had that not happened, what do you think would have happened to the gospel? It would have immediately gone down the drain, and it would have been dismissed as the great fakery of the first century, but that's not what happened. Anybody else before we move down and talk about a couple more items? Okay, let's turn to the sick. The sick, just like sin, is a great equalizer. The rich may have had a different means to bring them to the apostles than the poor did, but still it didn't matter. They all had the same problem. When you look at the word which is translated sick, that is a general term. Now, sometimes a person will say, I have cancer, or I have diabetes, or I have whatever. But in other cases, a person simply says, I'm sick. And here you have that general kind of description, a number of medical problems. And then in the middle of verse 15, before we get down to Don's question, what do we read about? There was Peter's shadow. And it was believed, we'll talk about whether or not that was actually the case, but it was thought that if Peter's shadow overshadowed somebody, just as you would be out and there's a shadow that's cast, what would that do? It would heal them. Now the word which is translated overshadowed is also used to describe Jesus' transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17, verse 5. And one source said, and I like the quote, he said, at Jesus' transfiguration, Peter had been overshadowed, and now some wanted to be overshadowed by him. When you think about that word overshadowed, what would it convey to you? We want to be overshadowed by Peter. Overshadowed would refer to? Okay, there were a couple answers.
Covering.
Well, covering, but maybe even beyond that.
His power.
I think that's the key idea that we want to bring out there. God's presence, God's power, God's glory. So the power, was it from Peter's shadow?
No.
Some people will look at that, I think, and think, well, that was where the power was. No, the power, just like the apostles' hands, the power was not in the hands, the power is not in the water when someone is baptized. The power is of God, but the way that that is manifested or given or demonstrated may come from a different place. Now, there are some people who, as they look at that, they say, well, they could not have been healed by Peter's shadow. What would your response to that be if you wanted to take the opposite view?
God can do anything.
All right. If he wanted to heal by looking at somebody, or heal by hands, or heal by a shadow, there are any number of means that he could use and did use. So that's not really all that great of an argument. Stan?
To me, the classic there is serpent.
Yeah. That would be another illustration that, well, you know, what power was in the serpent? There was none, but that was God's designated method to heal. And there's no indication that I can tell that people were not healed by it. In fact, that may have been a very productive thing, because what have we said about the number of people coming to Jerusalem? I mean, you've got loads of people coming in and in and in. And even if you take 1 second to touch people, I mean, still, that's going to wrap up a lot of time when you may have thousands of people coming in on a single day. Now, I didn't mention this in a previous class, but I do think it's appropriate to mention it now. Based on all we've said, do you think that this just happened within the period of a few days, a week? Do you think all these events happened within the period of a few days or a week?
I would say it'd have to be a little more than that.
Yeah. Suppose, how many people are in this community?
Pardon?
How many people are in this community? 30,000, okay, that would be my guess. How many people do you think in this committee out of 30,000 would say they're sick?
5%.
Depends on the season, maybe. 29,000. 29,000. Well, I think...
I would say half anyway.
I would say at least half. What about a person who wears glasses? Would they qualify as a sick? Remember that word, which is sick, it's a general word. Somebody says, well, you know, I can't see very well. And, you know, we have glasses and contacts and surgery. But what about for those folks? Didn't have those options. So you can have eye problems. And you have a lot of other health issues. So if you've got just one, Jerusalem had a lot of folks. So you could have, as far as the people, I mean, we're talking possibly about weeks, maybe months. And this is just day after day after day after day. Now, can you imagine trying to be an apostle and you go and you spend a couple times with each one? I'm going to heal you, you know, and in the name of Jesus Christ, you're healed. You might go hoarse trying to do all that. So I think it's very possible, and I have no difficulty believing that as Peter passed by, now, I wouldn't say that that's the way that necessarily everybody was healed, but at least some could have been healed in that manner. I remember, I've said it probably before, but in Nicaragua, we got up early one morning about 4 o'clock in the morning, and people were already lined up because they, I mean, lined up down the street and around the block, and I don't know how long the line was, but it was a long, long line because they heard Americans were there and they had come with medical care to aid them. I've never seen anything like that in my life. And trying to sort through that line, even if you were trying to do triage, go up to somebody and take 30 seconds or a minute, what's your problem, and then go on to the next. You know, dealing with that day in and day out, trying to deal with every person personally, to me that seems like that would have been almost impossible because people just keep coming. So this may have been God's mechanism to help offset some of that need. Glenda? Yeah, sure. And that would be one more way that God was able to heal people. And as I said, there were multiple ways to get that power out and use that through the apostles. So just because it was this way or that way, it would have been just as effective.
And not just mentions Peter here, but were the other apostles probably also not doing the same thing?
You would think.
In all areas?
Yes. This consumed a lot of the time. And then... as they say in Acts chapter 6, they get hammered with another responsibility and sort of hands up at that point. You know, we've got so much going on. We need some other helpers so we can get back and continue to teach. Because I think you also have to bear this in mind as well. We don't want to overlook this. Would it have been God's will for them to just heal everybody and then everybody goes home and continues to live in sin? No. Ultimately, what was the hope? We want to help you physically, but ultimately you need help where? Spiritually. So we're going to help you with your sight, or we're going to help you with your lame leg or whatever it might be, but you also need to be taught the gospel. So that could have been practical. Heal a bunch of people with the shadow, and then we're going to have a tent meeting at 5 o'clock, and everybody's invited to come. And certainly if you'd been healed of a terrible disease, you would hopefully be inclined to attend that meeting and hear the gospel. And hopefully several of these people will become Christians. Remember again what we talked about, that word multitude. Remember, multitudes, plural, were becoming Christians. So perhaps several of the people who had been sick were part of that group. Anybody else? Okay, let's go back and deal with a couple other items here. How many were healed? The end of verse 16. Everybody. That's expressed with the imperfect tense, ongoing action. That is amazing. All these people continuing to come, maybe tens upon tens of thousands, every single one. There was not a single failure. And then as you think about this, it certainly ties in well with Jesus' healings. No one was ever turned away. No one was told that he was too sick to be cured. No one was rejected because he lacked faith. And no one was told, you have to contribute to what to be healed? You contribute to our cause, our ministry, our little fun down here, and God is going to bless you. That's not how it worked. You have people coming from outside Jerusalem, surrounding cities. Some of those could have been Hebron, Bethlehem, Emmaus, Jericho, a lot of different places. And again, nobody goes back home sick. As I said, Luke didn't say how long that lasted, but it does seem to have been for a period of time. And then the other point, and this is where Don was a couple minutes back. The people who came were truly sick. Sometimes when you look, I would say oftentimes, when you look at the so-called crusades, the healing crusades today, you look at people and they can walk down the aisle. Well, my back hurts. Well, okay. You think everybody's back hurts at times? Well, yeah. You know, you go out and move 6 ton of stone, or maybe you go out there and you're doing some work on your vehicle and your body gets into some strange contortions. You know, your body hurts for a little while. So that's not really, though, what you have here as far as the healings. Couple quick points about that. The word which is translated vexed, that is a word which is described with the tense. Anybody want to guess what the tense is? Present. Ongoing action. So a person says, well, I hurt today. Well, okay, we're sorry about that. But tomorrow comes and the pain is not there. It's gone away. But then there's some other people. What's true of their life and how they hurt? They hurt today, they hurt tomorrow, they hurt the next day, they hurt from the time that they get up to the time that they go to bed, and it never stops. That's the idea that is conveyed by this word, which is translated vexed. And that word meant not just to hurt, but it meant to be tormented. Liddell and Scott, that's a source which helps define Greek words, noted how in other periods, noted how Homer used that word to describe pebbles which were swept or rolled away by water. Now, can you think about that? These, you know, there's that constant interaction with the pebbles and so forth. Then you have the demons. They're called unclean because the doctrines that they're involved with encourage people to be involved with immoral or unmoral behavior. Don, did that do enough for your answer or not? It didn't. Okay. All right. So why don't you finish out the thought? Okay.
Yeah, my question was, this is not the first time that unclean spirits, which to me it would be a mental issue.
It could be. Now remember, you have the fellow who talked about a son who cast himself into the fire.
Yeah.
So now it could have been a mental issue, but he's also, if you're in the fire, you're also suffering physically.
I understand.
Okay.
I mean, what we would term today a mental issue.
Yes.
Schizophrenia or whatever.
Right.
Spirits out of the girl into the swine. Now that's a totally different plateau you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're taking one mental issue and put them into another animal. I have a hard time wrapping my arms around or my head around that. You know, were there demons possessed people back then? We don't have demon possessed people here today.
Correct.
They say they're demon-possessed, but we know it's a mental issue now with our technology. So I wrap my head around that. I can't do it.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out what we're trying to wrap the head around.
Well, back when Jesus cast those demons out of that little girl into the pigs.
Okay.
And they ran off, right?
Right.
Now, that would be hard to say that was a mental thing, that this girl had a schizophrenic or was mentally unbalanced. Then you make the pigs unbalanced. I guess that could possibly be. I mean, Jesus could certainly do that. There's no problem with that.
Okay, so are we focused on the pigs or are we focused on...
Focused on the mental thing.
Okay.
Now, none of the Greek words indicate that these are mental issues. Is that right?
Demon-possessed, I think, is as far as I would go. And it was a very vexing, taxing problem that would cause people to do. For example, you have one fellow who was cutting himself. Now, that's not normal behavior. Now, today people will sometimes cut themselves for various reasons, not because they're demon-possessed, but because they're depressed or want attention or some other unfortunate beliefs. But it did apparently, I would almost go on record and say in every case it interfered with the mental process in some fashion.
But it wasn't, quote-unquote, a demon. Issue that these people had. Now, these people here, the unclean spirits would be a mental issue that they would have.
Yes.
Not an external being that's coming to possess them.
Okay, let's ask it this way. If the people were not demon possessed, would they have had a mental issue?
I don't know how to answer that.
Okay, my understanding would be no. Because once the demon is gone, the mental issue is gone. So as long as the demon was in there, they had the mental issue. Once the demon goes, the mental issue is gone. So what was causing the mental issue? I would infer that it was a demon. And if it was a demon that was causing the mental issue, then we would come back to the conclusion that, yes, demons did interfere with the proper mental functioning of people.
So there was, back in that culture, there was actually a demon. A being of some kind.
That possessed people and mess with the head in some way. And sometimes that messing with the head caused them to cut themselves or do some other crazy things.
Why don't we have that today?
Well, just as all the miraculous elements of the gospel, whether it would be the tongue speaking or the healing, when the word was completed, 1 Corinthians 13, Ephesians chapter 4, all of the miraculous went. Now, if you leave the demonic miraculous activity intact, but you don't have the supernatural healing and the supernatural demonic deliverance intact, you have a problem, don't you? Now you give Satan really the upper hand with that. But God said, Satan, you're going to be restricted, and we're also going to remove the miraculous power so people will have my word. Demons are still able to work just as Satan is. Remember, Peter talked about 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, the devil. He's like a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour. So he's not powerless. But as far as possessing people today, as you rightly said, doesn't have that power or authority. Bonnie, you raised a hand.
Well, back in Mark, in the first chapter, you know, it talks about Simon's wife's mother having the fever. And in verse 32 it says, and even when the sun did set, they brought unto him all that were diseased and them that were possessed with devils. So does that kind of connect with what Don was
Demon possession was a real phenomenon in the first century, and it did some terrible things. When they asked for permission to enter into the swine, and when they went into the pigs went over the cliff. So again, even, and I find that to be an interesting story, not story in the sense that it's not true, but it is true. I find that to be fascinating because it interfered with the mental process of those animals to the point where they ran off the cliff. At least that seems to be the implication of that. So whether it was a young person or whether it was an adult, it caused them to do some things. Remember the story about demon possession? You have the fellow, he's running around cutting himself, he's naked. And once the demons go out, what's the Bible say? He's now in what kind of mind? He's now in the right mind. So you can look at that passage as well and demonstrate that demons interfered with the thinking process. Now, you might claim, and I don't know that this would be too much of a stretch, that does it take much to mess with a person's mind? I'm not being funny about that. I'm just being serious.
Well, some people it does and some it doesn't.
But some medicines will cause the mind to do weird things. People see bugs on their wall and other kind of creepy things. What happens if a person gets distracted? Maybe the doctor has given you some serious news, or maybe there is a news story that comes up, or something is prominent in your mind. Can you forget some things? Yeah. People say commonly what? I was distracted. We read about distracted drivers and so forth. People run off the road. People hit people. Just for something as trying to take a phone call or trying to send a text message. So, and we ask the question, where was your mind? So it's very easy for our minds to become misaligned in some way, whether it's medicine or it's a distraction. And if the devil gets in there somehow, I can imagine that that really would have messed with the heads of people.